Just in case you're wondering what I'm always doing with my phone, I record the sermons, by the way, every Sunday, and they are on our website. So if you ever want to listen to them again or refer them to somebody else to listen to, just check our website and you'll find everything there. Well, as you know, I'm doing this series on the Ten Commandments. And today, as we did last week, I'm going to deal with the Sixth Commandment, thou shalt not murder. Now, this week, we're looking particularly at Jesus' exposition of the commandment in Matthew. And it's important to note that whenever a commandment forbids something, it also enjoins something. For instance, when God says, you shall have no other gods before me, it also means I should be the priority and the main and the only God in your life. The Sixth Commandment says, human life shall not destroy or weaken. And we looked at that aspect, the negative aspect of it last week. But it also says, to live an ethic of radical love and forgiveness. And that's what we're looking at this week. Jesus, notice here, he says, turn the other cheek. Well, as you probably know, this ethic has been roundly criticized and often disregarded. Yet no one ever rejects this ethic because it's too low and unworthy. Rather, they say it's too high and too lofty. What I hope to show you is indeed that it's not too high and lofty, and frankly, is the only hope for you, me, in this world. But to understand this ethic, turn the other cheek, and the rest of what's happening in this passage, you must see that it's part of a whole package, in particular, a package of our different relationships. Because Christianity is a set of radically connected and altered relationships. Like a Christian is someone who has come into a radically new relationship with God, and then consequently creates a brand new relationship with yourself that then is followed by a different attitude and relationship with others and the rest of the world. And Jesus' teaching, turn the other cheek, doesn't make sense unless you see it as part of this package of relationships. Why it says in verse 24, by the way, if your fellowship with your fellow human being is not in order, you shouldn't come forward. Well, it says not worship God, but actually we've interpreted as not coming forward to you and receive communion. You can't have one relationship with the other. And that's why Jesus says in verse 47, what more are you doing than others? In other words, if you are a follower of mine and are radically transformed on the inside, you've got the ability not just to love your friends, but also your enemies. So, with that in mind, let's unpack these set of relationships. First, we'll consider what is a Christian's understanding of him or herself. Second, what a Christian's relationship with others looks like. And then finally, let's examine the root of these relationships, our relationship with God. So, first, a follower of Christ has a unique, restructured attitude towards him or herself. Verse 22, I say to you that if you are angry with a brother or a sister, you will be liable to judgment. And if you insult a brother or sister, you will be liable to the council. And if you say you fool, you will be liable to the hell of fire. Jesus says, you heard it said, thou shalt not murder. But when Jesus says that, he's not talking about the Old Testament scriptures, right? Because if he was, it would have said it is written. Instead, he's talking about the rabbis or the present religious teachers and what they were saying about the law. And these rabbis were saying, only if you physically kill someone are you subject to judgment. But for Jesus, this interpretation does not understand the import of the law. Even if you're angry with someone, you're guilty. The Greek word he uses for angry here means literally to swell up. Kind of refers to a slow burn situation. So it may begin with distaste for someone, moves on to dislike, eventual resentment, bitterness, and finally outright anger and maybe physical harm. Then Jesus goes on to say, anyone who insults someone is guilty. The Greek word for insult, raka, literally means calling somebody you nobody. And therefore, when you treat people as a non-person or inconsequentially, you are again breaking the sixth commandment.
It happens, for instance, when we roll our eyes at someone for having said or done something we think is stupid. We husbands tend to do this with our wives sometimes, for instance. Or today we have these two ends of the political spectrum, whether you're progressive or conservative, and each tends to look down, roll their eyes at the other. Then lastly, Jesus says, anyone who says you fool breaks this commandment as well. The Greek word is moros, from which we get the word moron. And I think you all know what it means. Anyone who looks down, ridicules, or moron-like scorns someone, you're breaking the sixth commandment. Okay, you might be thinking, but surely I'm not as bad as the guy who kills someone? Yes and no. No, you haven't physically killed somebody. Yes, and that your attitude, believe it or not, can lead to murder and shows that you can too be a killer if all the circumstances came together. See, the difference between a Christian and a religious person is a Christian understands the inwardness of sin. The difference between a murderer and you are quantitative, not qualitative. A slow distaste for someone can grow into resentment, to wanting to see someone else knocked down, and to something even worse. So for instance, every acorn, I've used this expression before, every acorn has the potential to grow into a big oak tree, in fact, into a forest. But it can only do so when it's nourished with water, soil, and nutrients. Still, the potential is there. And likewise, Jesus says, the only difference between you, me, and the murderer is quantitative. How would we have acted if, like a murderer, let's say a murderer, was born into a poor black Chicago neighborhood, faced with no economic prospects, surrounded by gang violence, and living in a broken home? The only difference between the person who was born in this environment and you and me is the acorn, is that his acorn was nourished, whereas ours was not. Followers of Christ understand the inward condition and power of sin is in all of us. A Christian, therefore, does not say, yes, I believe in the Ten Commandments, but they don't apply to me because I'm a pretty good person. The true Christian says, I see how self-centered I am and how it impacts my relationship with others. I see if my circumstances were different, I could do what that person did. G.K. Chesterton wrote a series of detective novels whose main character was Roman Catholic priest Father Brown. Some of you may have seen the Father Brown series on TV. And at one point, someone asked Father Brown, how is it that you always seem to figure out those murders and how the murderer thinks? Father Brown says, it's all a theological issue. No one is good until he knows how bad he is or might be. Until he questions the right he has to all this snobbery, this sneering, this talking about criminals, as if there were apes in a forest 10,000 miles away, well, he doesn't get it. Again, unless you understand the potential that exists in your heart to commit the sins you condemn other people for, you'll never be able to keep your pride and scorn of them in check and thus able to truly love them. But what does it look like? Well, Jesus gives us a case study of what this radical new attitude looks like. And he tells us again in verse 39, as I said before, if someone strikes you in the right cheek, turn the other also. Now, Jesus is not suggesting we should never stop injustice and let people walk all over us. That's just plain silly. Because elsewhere, Jesus doesn't teach that, and nor does Paul. In fact, Jesus questioned the authorities as to why he was slapped in the face. Likewise, Paul questioned the authorities as to why he was imprisoned as a Roman citizen. And therefore, Christians are supposed to stand for justice and against oppression. So what is Jesus talking about? He's not referring to someone who is physically attacking or slapping you, okay? He's not referring to that. He's referring rather that the slap on the cheek is his way of talking about someone who insults you. All right? Someone who insults you. And therefore, what he's talking about and saying is that when someone insults you, do not get worried about saving face, your dignity, and your honor, and thus get in the way of helping and dealing with the person who's doing so. When Jesus and Paul, again, challenged the authorities, they were not concerned about saving face. That wasn't the issue for them. Rather, they simply wanted to point out to the authorities the injustice that they were committing. We, on the other hand, say or think things like this. How dare you say that to me? Do you know who I am or who you're talking to? Why? Because, again, we're worried about saving face and protecting our honor. But a Christian has an attitude towards herself that she at least should not be worried about that. She seeks justice, yes, but always wants to readily forgive and give people a second chance to redeem themselves. Now, that Jesus says, if someone wants to take your coat, give your cloak as well. That does not mean if someone steals your wallet, you say, well, you've missed cash in my pocket, right? It doesn't mean that. Instead, it means be prepared to give the person who has wronged you a chance to make things right. Now, let me be clear here. I'm not suggesting every transgression deserves a second chance. There are some transgressions, as we've seen in the church, where abuse happens and that person should not be in the same kind of circumstance again. Still, there are many other situations that there can be a second chance. And here's a way to think it through. What you did to me was wrong. I do want justice, but not because I need you to honor me. Still, I'm not going to let you continue to sin against me because that wouldn't help you. But anytime you want to be friends and you want to get back into a decent relationship, I'm ready to give you a second chance. Why? Because I want you to go down the right way, and that's the best thing for you. And the best thing for everybody else around you as well, for that matter. So that's the first point. Second point, and we've already begun to deal with this, what does a radically oriented relationship with other people look like? Verse 44, love your enemies. Some people say this is incredibly impractical. Do you realize if you love people like this, they're going to walk all over you? But as I've already shown, that it doesn't mean this, that if you love your enemies, it means letting them walk all over you. Rather, once your attitude towards yourself changes, you will want to forgive your enemies and to do so for their sake. Why? Well, because simply you'll say to yourself this, I was an enemy. I did wrong things. If I decided I'm going to hold a grudge against this person, how can I expect God to forgive me? If I won't forgive this person, maybe the three things he's done against me, how can I expect God to forgive me the 3,000 things I've done against God? I'm a savior, a sinner saved by God's grace. And therefore, I see no need for vengeance and honor. But again, you might see this as being impractical, opening your heart to people. But consider, I would say, it's the exact opposite. How impractical it is to look out for just number one, worried about being ripped off and not trusting anybody. Such a person, what happens? He or she just wraps himself up into a tighter circle, so no one can harm them, and they're not vulnerable. You may not get hurt, but you also end up lonely, you end up bitter, you don't know what it means to love and be loved. And how does this impact society? Why are we so divided politically? Why is there so much distrust of our institutions in each other? It's because we do not open our hearts to each other and turn the other cheek, that there is so much personal and societal discontent and brokenness in today's world. That's point two. Let me just conclude quickly with an illustration for our last point. It's regarding the true story about a Tsar of Russia way back when. The Tsar's dear friend died, and his friend gave the Tsar's son to keep and raise. And the Tsar honored his friend's wish and raised his son. And one day the son entered the army where he became an accountant. But because he got into financial trouble from gambling, the son embezzled funds to get out of his debt. One day the son, having looked over the books, realized the authorities would soon find out what he'd done. And he thought the best thing to do was to kill himself because of the dishonor that he would have to face. It'd be just too much. To get up the nerve, though, to kill himself, he started drinking. But he drank so much that he soon passed out before he could kill himself. Meanwhile, the Tsar was the kind of person who liked to spy on his people. He would dress up sometimes in a corporal's uniform and go out into his army to hear what the people were saying and doing. And he just so happened to come into the room where the son had passed out over the financial books. He looked at the books, realized what had happened. He added up what the debt was and said in his note, that which he left behind, "I will make good the full amount of this debt." He signed the note as the Tsar and sealed it with his ring and left it beside his son. When the young man woke up, he found the note and he couldn't believe it. "The Tsar had seen everything I've done, and yet he still loves me and forgives me my debt with his seal." Well, the gospel teaches exactly the same thing, doesn't it? Jesus Christ in his incarnation came incognito as a man, and he sees in your heart everything, all the things you wouldn't dare want anybody around here to see or know about. And yet he still loves you, and he has sealed his forgiveness for you with his own blood on the cross. And if you get that, your relationship with him and your neighbor, with God's help, will radically change. Amen.